Hey, welcome to Mad Beef, the Australian rollerblading podcast. This is Mikey Lynch, and I'm bringing you the second episode talking with Tasmanian vert skating champion Shane Yost. In this episode, we answer a few questions from the metaphorical mailbag sent in by our listeners. We talk about building a backyard vert ramp, the world rollerblading titles, a Launceston toilet bowl skate park, opposite 1080s, forward 1260s, and more. Enjoy.
Hey, there we go. It's working.
Yeah, good work, mate. Here we are.
Look at that, eh? I learned a couple of things from last time.
Go team. So you're straight off the ramp, straight into this second podcast episode.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I've been kind of mucking around all day. I have to say we've got just the most immaculate weather at the moment. This time of year, like autumn, is just, you get 20 degree days and it's just crystal clear skies. And yeah, so long as it, you know, sort of doesn't get into a fit of raining, you'll just have a string of days in a row that are just absolutely picture perfect.
Awesome. So you do you have a ramp on your property, or what's the go with this?
Yeah, so if you've sort of seen on my Instagram and on Facebook and stuff, that ramp you see in the, like, kind of, it looks like it's in a paddock, like out the back. That's actually at the back of my property. So where I am, where we live, which is basically between Myrtleford and Bright, sort of upcountry in Victoria, on the doorstep of the Victorian Alps. Yeah, I've got a little ramp sort of nestled in a strand of blue gum trees there. So, yeah, it's I kind of made that joke that I was like, oh, give me five because I'm finishing up a session and I'm on my way home. Well, I was just from the backyard to the house.
Yeah. I figured that's where it was. And you built it with some people, did you? Or did you pay some people to come in and build it? What was the actual construction story?
Yeah, so I mean that's probably worth a whole podcast in itself.
Yeah,
it was it was basically a 2-year project that started basically when I started at Carter, because I work at Carter Holt Harvey now, so we make plywood. So when I was there when I first started, I'm just looking around going, plywood, you know what you can make out of plywood? Ramps. And then I just started mulling over, well, I wonder if I could actually build a ramp in the backyard. And then that was, a 2-year process of just, it was crazy, man. Like, I'd like to go down the rabbit hole with that project, but, it was massive.
Future episode, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Like, because it literally warrants, like, the stories, the overcoming, the problems that I come up with. Essentially, I built the thing myself. I got a buddy who just lives across the road to clear the trees. Then I flattened the ground and did everything myself, started putting in the foundations. I talked to him because he's a builder, so I got the inside story on, and I showed him my designs. I drew up the designs and stuff, and he fine-tuned them. Then I got my stepdad. Without my stepdad, it would have taken me way longer. Stepdad came over from Tassie, and he helped me lay the foundations. And then about halfway through the project, he came over to help me basically build the back part of the ramp in to create a shed. So, Zach helped me probably with about 10% of the project, which doesn't sound like much, but it's a hell of a lot, which was awesome. Yeah. And then the rest of it is just myself, just building it myself in the backyard.
Every boy's dream. The listeners can kind of imagine you're still all sort of sweaty from your run today.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I'm glad we're not using the video because, I literally have just come off having a good session on the ramp and then coming on. I kept having a look at the time going, I got to head inside because, I got to do the podcast. So I knew today was going to be a bit funky because, I had a bunch of things to do and I was supposed to skate this morning, which didn't happen. It's kind of funny, like these days I can't force skating anymore. It's got to kind of happen organically. I've got to feel like I want to ride. And if I don't want to ride, then just nothing happens. I just kind of go out there and just kind of twiddle my thumbs because these days I ride by myself. And when you ride by yourself, it's a very different story. Plus, I'm a lot different. I'm a different person now than what I used to be a long time ago. And a long time ago, it didn't matter, man. Like, I could literally force a session. If I didn't feel good, I'd be like, nah, grab the horse by the reins and just wrestle the thing into submission. These days, can't do that because you just risk getting hurt. And I don't have the volume in the legs and in my neurological system to really allow myself to do that anymore. I can't do that. It just requires way too much energy, and I need to be practicing consistently day after day. It's one of the biggest things that I've noticed these days, and it's become a real hurdle for myself because I don't start to feel good unless I've got, you know, 3 to 4 weeks under my belt of riding consistently, like day after day, that I don't start to feel comfortable in my groove. And if I'm not doing that, which is virtually impossible, you know, living a normal lifestyle, you just can't ride every day. It just doesn't work. So, you know, with all the different things in life and all that kind of stuff that happens. So it's kind of difficult for me to find that groove and to feel comfortable. So if I get stuck in a string of days or a week goes by and I can't ride, then I'm less inclined to ride. Like, even though I want to, I'm just like, well, you know what? I'm going to have to ride for a few days to start feeling good again so that I can get, you know, that real enjoyment and comfortable, like being comfortable again. So, yeah.
Getting that slow stage, as they say.
Yeah, man. Like, it's a funny thing. It's not so much the flow state. Like, that term gets thrown around a lot. And I don't like to use it. It's a little bit of a cliche. But at the end of the day, to be in the groove is 100% flow state. And, whereas before I could wrestle things into submission and make flow state happen, which is a bit of a rarity, but, it just doesn't happen like that anymore. And it just – I've got to find – it almost becomes a superstition. You need things to fall into line in a certain way, you know, roll the dice in a certain way for it to kind of happen. But I have to say – you know, I do a lot of gym work and I do a lot of movement-based training, and I can find flow state in a lot of places. Like, I don't need to rely upon just skating to find that state of mind. So I could be on a trail, for example, and if I'm breathing and I'm feeling what I'm doing and I've got a little, you know, I've got some tunes playing and I can fall into the moment, then I can achieve what it is that I'm after and I can get that buzz out of it. Because when you do find flow state and when you can enter it relatively easily, it becomes it's a real buzz. Like, you know, it feels amazing. So I've been lucky to be able to translate what I learned on the ramp into other activities and to find that, you know, that buzz, which is kind of cool. So anyway, that's another podcast probably talking about that kind of stuff.
Well, I'm causing the trouble because I'm asking the questions. So one more thing.
No, man, that's cool. Like, I'm happy to to facilitate. But I did read as I sort of continued on my skating journey, I guess that's a bit of a segue, but I did start reading a lot. So I was working am I sort of jumping ahead, or did you have some other questions that you wanted to ask?
Let's pick that back up a sec. So just three more quick things. Let's see if it's quick. We'll see how we go.
Sure.
Thing number one, and again, you're allowed to say this is for a future conversation. Are you currently just skating against yourself for yourself, or is there something you're working towards at the moment in terms of your skating?
Yeah. So first and foremost, I built a ramp. During COVID and when I changed career path and all that kind of stuff, I started to sort of, I guess, want to skate more. I wanted to skate more, and being up country, I wasn't really presented, like, I got to drive 4 hours to Melbourne to get to anywhere close to a ramp that's worth rideable. So at that stage, I was like, okay, let's start riding again. So I did start riding. Every weekend I started going down to Cranbourne. I'd go down to the Shed because it's an indoor skate park. It's one of the best ramps that we've got here in Australia by far. It's indoors, which is amazing, so you don't have to worry about the weather. And I started doing that on a frequent basis. However, as I started to do that more often, I was faced with a bit of a conundrum because every time I went down there, I spent a day getting used to the ramp, then a day where I could start to feel comfortable and start riding. It wasn't enough. So it was really a case of, I have to wait a week before I can ride for 2 days, and those 2 days aren't enough. What can I do to fix that? What can I do to remedy it? Well, if I had a ramp that was closer to home, that would be awesome. All right, how do we do that? We build a ramp in the backyard. And then I'm like, Well, you know what? It's not too outrageous. We've got 5 acres. I'll throw it by the missus and see what she says. And she's like, yeah, go for it. If you want to build a ramp, these are the places you could put it. Go for it. Yeah, I'm okay with that. And I'm like, all right, this is awesome. Anyway, so that led down the path of building the ramp and wanting to skate more often. However, in the back of my mind, I kept seeing the World Roller Games come up all the time. And I kept kind of missing my window of opportunity to kind of jump into that arena again. Anyway, at the start of this year, I saw it popped up again. It's in Italy this year. It's in September. And I'm like,
all of you, shame.
Yeah. I'm like, you know what? I haven't seen these guys for forever. Oh, look, I have no delusions of grandeur. I know where my level is at. I know what I can achieve. And I know, like, my limits. I know that I'm not going to be the same skater that I used to be. I'm not playing myself down or anything. I'm just being very realistic about the time constraints, how old I am, like level of dedication. I know what it takes to get to the top level. I'm not going to be there. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. However, having a bit of a crack and going to a contest and seeing everyone ride again is
showing up. Yeah.
Opened up the door, man. And I'm like, you know what? I want to do that. So,
awesome.
So at the moment, there's a little bit of pressure on me because I want to ride. That's my goal. I want to get to the roller games this year. That's my goal. However, I'm still waiting to hear back from Skate Australia. Me and Sam Fogarty are looking to go away. So Sam contacted me and he's like, oh, have you heard about roller games? And I'm like, yeah, man, I want to go. And he's like, yeah, I want to go too. So, yeah, I've been steadily sending emails and trying to contact them. But the tricky thing is nobody has represented Australia for vert yet at the World Roller Games. So Skate Australia, who when I was skating speed skating, I had a lot of contact with Skate Australia. You used to have to get the membership to compete at Australian titles for speed skating. Mm-hmm. So I know how the governing body works, but I don't think they know how we fit into the scheme of things. It's a little bit different for Park because Park has contests around the globe. They're constantly the FIS event that's coming up in France very soon, that's not very far away, is a qualifier for the World Games. So what happens for vert? Well, nothing's been announced in terms of qualifiers for vert because there really isn't any contests. Yeah. You've got the one in where Nicola I can't remember his last name. I can never pronounce it. It's either the Netherlands or it's Germany. He's going to kill me because you know, we talk a lot on the socials and stuff. But I know there's a contest that he has that's close by him. And I think there was one just recently in Barcelona, which looked pretty awesome. Yep. But once again, I haven't seen anything in terms of qualifiers or any other vert contests around to, you know, for qualification. So we're kind of up in the air. So I'm kind of hoping that we can qualify through, I don't know, if we can create a video or whatever or get a wild card or anything, because I know the governing body that invites athletes to the World Games, they basically say your country, your governing body in your country takes care of the qualification process. So that's why I contacted Skate Australia, because they look after it. But it's just a matter of, well, I still haven't heard anything. So anyway, we'll see what happens. That's another little side quest that I'm kind of on at the moment.
That's super exciting, man. I hope it all sort of slots into place. You know how, like, when we were kids, there used to be like kind of afternoon and Saturday morning TV shows that have cartoons and things, and then in between there'd be like letters from kids who'd sent in, and they'd read out the letters and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
So 100%. So we've got a little mailbag, and Chris Pullar wants to know when you're going to ride the Mega.
Yeah, that keeps coming up. I love you, Chris. Chris is awesome. I've known Chris for such a long time, such an inspiration in our community in the whole of Australia, man. Like, he's always organising events. He's always getting people pumped up. yeah, kudos to Chris and shout out to him, man, because he does a lot behind the scenes that a lot of people don't know about. And yeah, that a lot of this, you know, I guess the modern popularity of skating is because of his perseverance and working in different areas and doing stuff. So some really cool stuff that he's doing. Needless to say, look, man, like, funnily enough, it was either 2000 or it was 2001. There was a contest at the Hard Rock Cafe in Vegas, which was the MTV Sports and Music Festival. And yeah, that ramp was 20 foot high. It had 18 foot transitions with 2 feet of vert, with 36 foot high roll-ins on one side, on left and right, both sides of the ramp. It was, once again, it was a half pipe setup. So in terms of having ridden something like that in the past, not in terms of jumping over a big gap and then hitting a quarter pipe, but I've ridden a 20-foot half pipe before. I know what it's like. 20-foot, you don't pump. You rely upon the speed you generate either by rolling in or by other means. Matt Hoffman in the old days used to get towed in on a motorcycle and used to hit a big quarter pipe and used to go ridiculous heights, you know, into the air.
Yeah.
All because you literally cannot generate the kinds of speeds you need by yourself, which is what we found out. Dropping in on a 20-foot half pipe was out of this world, because it was the only time when you tried to mellow your pump out, but it didn't work, because you just couldn't generate the speed because the transitions were so large. So anyway, yeah, we slowly got used to this thing over about 5 days hanging out there at the Hard Rock Cafe, which was just such a surreal experience. They were interviewing a few of the bands on site. So, yeah, I believe the Foo Fighters were there, Bush were there, and a few other bands. So seeing those guys mill around at the same time that we were, like, practicing and riding was just, like, you know, it was pretty awesome stuff. For me, that was, you know, once again, we're only talking about first or second year, third year that I was a pro. So I was still starstruck in terms of just being able to ride in the pros and being around the guys that I'd idolized for so long, and then, you know, rubbing shoulders with skating royalty and then rock star royalty and stuff like that was pretty crazy. Yeah. Needless to say, yeah, that contest was pretty wild. There was only five of us, I believe. There was Ty, I'm pretty sure there was Tig there, Tig Chris. There was Eitan Kramer. There was Cesar. There was myself, Mike Budnick. And I can't remember if there was anyone else. I know it was a very small field and it was all like invite only. Like, you couldn't qualify for it. It was just invite. And yeah, man, we had high air contests and we had a big best trick contest there. And it was just crazy. So it's not so much the quarter pipe that scares me so much. It's more of the gap. So, yeah, I will hit it. I'm going to have a crack at the mega ramp at some stage. But, I'll be honest, it scares the hell out of me. It's not something that I've actually ridden, but I've ridden that style of transition, so I know what it's like. However, I just don't have the volume and confidence in my skating to go and ride it at the moment. That's probably one of the biggest things that's holding me back. When Nell was over, and I know Sam went down on the Sunday, and I went down and had a look. I stayed with Nell and hung out with him, which was such an awesome thing. It was brilliant, because I haven't seen Nell in well over 15 years, so we got to chat and hang out and have a skate together. Gosh. Mm. Yeah. You have no idea. Just chatting to him, like, when you get to know him, like, you'll learn. Yeah, like, everyone knows how cool Nell is until you hang out with him, and then it's like his coolness factor goes into intergalactic. You know what I mean? Like, his base level of coolness is already way above everyone else's. And then you hang out with him for a while. And when you know him for as long as I have, and I've gone over to Spain and I've hung out with him and skated with him over there, and we've toured together and we've done skating together, like, I'm telling you now, man, you don't know Nell and his level of coolness until you get to, like, live with the guy. You know what I mean? He'll do anything for you. He'll go to bat for you. He'll defend you until the death. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he's one of those guys that is just so genuine and so passionate about what he does. Like, he will, you know, sell his soul to, you know, make rollerblading, you know, to bring it back into the spotlight. You know what I mean? And he won't just do it because he wants himself to be in the limelight. You know, he does it because he wants the sport to be in the limelight. That's the difference. That's what makes Nell as cool as he is, because it's not about him. It's about the sport, and it's the sport of vert skating. Blading, and he loves blading, and we all do. But, you know, for us vert riders, it's at the very heart of what we do, you know. You know, that's not saying that I don't like any of our sport. I love everything. I'm so in awe of the park guys, the street guys, the slalom guys, the speed guys, because I've dabbled in different areas and I know what it takes to get to the levels that require, you know, the elite levels. So I can respect it. I can understand it. And that just, I love all the levels. It's just what I do. It's just back in the day when I was riding in Tassie, it was just, we rode. I think I mentioned this last time. We rode everything because you had to, because riding a 9-foot cement vert ramp was a death sentence for both yourself and your gear. You just got wrecked. So you had to ride everything. And that's what we used to do. And it taught me to respect.
This might relate to back in those days. The other letterbox question. The other letterbox question. Well, you know this one because it was on your Facebook. I don't know if Nick Legg and is it Elliot Chapman are talking about the same thing. Nick Legg wants to know about the toilet bowl.
And then Chapman
mentions the shit house. And I don't know if that's talking about the same thing, but
it's the same thing. Yeah, so man, like that could I'm not gonna wander too much off. Funnily enough, after the podcast, Nick Legg sent me a message. So Nick, me and Nick go back forever. So remember in the story previously, for those that are just listening to this episode, Nick was the top of the pops. He was the most amazing skater, vert skater. He rode everything too. Like he'd be doing rails, he'd be doing the whole lot. So Nick was the man that I chased down. He was a really good close, and he still is a close buddy of mine. We chat now and then online and stuff, catch up whenever I'm down in Tassie. And I'm going to say straight out that if it wasn't for Nick and me trying to chase him down for his level, I probably wouldn't have gone as far as I had, because I would have been so much further behind everyone else. So it was seeing him ride and being motivated, inspired by how Nick was just so incredible at skating at that particular time, that I pushed myself to want to be like Nick. Like, that's what I wanted to do. So I don't know if I actually kind of mentioned how integral he was in my skating.
I think you were talking about that kind of friendly competition thing and how.
Oh, yeah, 100%. But I just wanted to highlight he was an integral part of my success, because, as I said, I would have been so much further behind. Needless to say, Nick hit me up and said, why didn't you talk about the toilet bowl? And I said, well, I didn't have time because there's a lot to talk about. Okay, so toilet bowl. During my formative years, there was a thing created in Launceston called the toilet bowl. Basically, we wanted a skate park because we didn't have one. There wasn't a skate park around. We had Summerhill Ramp that was falling down. It was a death trap to ride. We rode it to try to learn stuff, but Nick actually had splinters surgically removed from his body because of crashes on that ramp is how bad it was. I remember seeing, and I kid you not, it was about a foot long splinter that went through his wrist guard. It could have gone through his wrist or his hand or anything, but one particular day, I'm telling you, it was a foot long. It came off and it went through his wrist guard, and we were just horrified. We were like, yeah, well, I guess that's the end of the session for today. So that being said, there was nothing else. There was Royal Park, which was just a half pipe. There was Summerhill, which was a half pipe, and that was it in those days. So what was our aim? We wanted a skate park. The council wasn't, you know, they weren't really listening to us. They didn't have the money. So we're like, what's the next best thing? let's just build a skate park. All right, cool. We'll build a bunch of rails, build a bunch of ramps, but where are we going to put them? So then we went to one of the car parks there in Launceston. It's three levels, and I forget the streets that it's located on. It's a pretty famous car park. It was the highest car park at Launceston at that time. It's pretty much slap bang in town. And we convinced the car park to let us use the car park on Sundays and to allow us to store all the ramps and gear in the bottom area of the car park that was kind of closed in. So what we used to do is we'd come in Sunday morning, we'd go in, we'd get our cars all set up, and we'd stack all the stuff on top of the cars, drag it all to the top of the car park, three levels up, and set up a mini skate park on top of the car park. And we'd session the day and have a blast. And everyone rode together. This was the strangest thing for me. Back in those days, that's what we used to do. So when I came to the mainland and when I used to tour, this animosity between the sports was so foreign to me, I just didn't understand it. I'm like, why do the skateboarders hate the bladers? Why do the bladers dislike the skateboarders? Why do the BMXers? Like, it just didn't make any sense to me. It was just like, I don't understand this, because all of us rode together. We had the toilet bowl together, and we used to, like, that's just what we used to do. So it was just, it was awesome. Yeah. And then we had a magazine. There wasn't much of a magazine. It was just a photocopied thing that one of the guys, Morley,
I think, zine, like they used to call it back in the day, didn't they? With just like the Z, zine.
Yeah, totally. So every month they used to put out, you know, with pictures and all that kind of stuff. And I remember I felt really chuffed one day because I got asked to do a little interview in the back of the Toilet Bowl magazine. And I thought that was like the bee's knees at that stage. It was pretty awesome. So, the Toilet Bowl moved from that to every now and then we'd charter a bus and we'd go down, because Hobart had some skate parks and ramps that we didn't have up in Launceston. So what we did, and there was about 20 of us. So then what we'd do is we'd charter a bus. We'd get on that bus on a Saturday or a Sunday morning, and then we'd drive all the way down and we'd choose. We'd go, all right, what spots would we go? We'd go West Hobart, the Snake Run. We'd go to the Domain. We'd go to Rosny. And then there might be another, I can't remember, like there might have been somewhere else that we used to go to. And we'd choose two or three spots that we'd hit up and we'd session, and then we'd session through the day, and then we'd all jump back on the bus. We'd hit up Macca's, because at that stage, Macca's in Hobart, in Glenorchy, was the only Macca's in the state at the time.
Yeah.
So it was like a real treat for everybody to get off the bus, get their Macca's. Then, of course, we'd sneakily head to the bottle
KFC,
shop.
KFC, didn't we? Way before.
Oh, yeah, Macca's. It was KFC. And then, we'd hit up the bottle shop as well, and then everyone would have a party on the way home. And it was just such an amazing experience. You probably couldn't get away with that today at all, but heading down to Hobart, jumping on the bus, sessioning up, everyone would go off, everyone would be cheering for each other, mad sessions, then get back on the bus, you know, eat up a storm at Macca's, and then drink the night away and just have a blast. And it was just such a cool time, man. Like, just so many tricks were learnt, so many things went down, and so many stories and myths were created from the toilet bowl days. That was just incredible. Like, it's really hard to describe kind of that time, but it was fun, man. Like, honestly, toilet bowl was one of those big things that I wanted to talk about it in the first podcast. We didn't have time. We honestly didn't have the time for it.
Well, mate, I'm obviously showing you that I'm hoping I'm assuming we'll be having at least a third convo sometime. So I'm happy to, devote a chunk of this time today and following some of these threads and talking in this direction and that direction. Like, it's all great stuff. And
as you probably learned, I can talk. I'm very passionate about what I do. I love skating. And once you get me started, you won't shut me up.
So given that we've got, I've got a kind of hard finish around five, let's just try and take the next step, because we got kind of just on the brink of your first international skating and then we had to finish up last time. So is there a way that we can kind of just do that next step along, you know, what it was like to kind of be moving into that becoming, you know, the regular, you know, what that life then is like becoming a
pro competitor. Crazy. 100%. And it was it happened not straight away, but I remember leading up. I remember before, when was it, 98. So the lead up to me going away, and I remember the middle of the year, and I remember it like yesterday. And it was just like, if I want to do anything with this, I need to be doing it full time. I can't. Yeah. And this leads into my problem now, because I know what it takes. I get to the door, and it's like you're knocking at the door, and it's like, you know what you have to do. Well, you have to spend 7 days a week writing, because you need to be that fine-tuned and that dialed in to your writing that you need to be that confident. And as I said, at that point I knew if I couldn't do this full-time, I wouldn't be able to go to the next step. So when I finally got that chance, Rosa's told me, you're going to have a contract. January 1st, you're going to have a contract. And then I teed up work and I quit work on January 1st. And then from there, it was just like, well, what do I do? And then I'm like, well, what do athletes do? Well, they train. They train a lot. Well, skating training, that's fine. I'll be skating pretty much all the time. What else can I do? Well, I'll go to the gym and I'll start running and stuff. So, yeah, I literally fell out of work and just went full time and was just like, I can't believe that I get to do this. And then within the month, it was like, the paycheck wasn't crazy, but it was sustainable. Rosa's was like already starting to plan out the year in terms of the things that we would be doing. And then we got the trip to R&D. So with Rosa's, every year, all the team riders would go to Italy to the factory and we'd do R&D. So we talk about the skate that was coming up. We design T-shirts. We do all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it was like getting that call from Rhonda, who was the distributor in Australia at the time, the team manager for Australia. And she's like, yeah, all the riders, we've got a ticket for you. You got to go to over to Italy for the R&D. And here am I. I'm just like, I'm going from what I felt like grommy status to like, yeah. What? So I can't describe to you how blown away and excited and like, you know what I mean? Like just starstruck at that point.
Yeah, kid in the candy store sort of thing, isn't it? It's like, I'm suddenly, yeah.
And then they teed up, I believe they teed up a contest. It was either that year, it was either Birmingham or it was Bercy, because there was a big French contest, Bercy, that would happen at the start of every year as well, and they used to coincide with heading to Rosa's. So I remember many times going over to Rosa's, and then at the same time we'd do the R&D. Francesco Mattioli was our team manager, and he'd take us up to the Dolomites. He'd take us up to his chalet up in the mountains. And, of course, in January, February, that's, you know, the winter time for the Northern Hemisphere. So we'd go hit up the ski fields, have a blast, then come back, do a little bit more R&D, then we'd go away, do a contest, maybe do a show, and then from there we'd come back to Australia, come back for a couple of weeks to a month, and then the season would pretty much start. And at that time when I was over in Italy, I was like, I got asked, I think I've mentioned this last time, so what contests would you like to do this year? And I go, all of them? And he's like, Francesco looks at me and he's like, well, we've got a budget and you've got a budget and you can't really go to all the contests because of the flights. And I'm like, what if I just go over and stay there instead of coming backwards and forwards? And he's like, no one does that. And I'm like, I don't care. I'll stay over there. I don't need to come back to Australia. If I can stay over there, I'm happy to stay there. And he's like, well, you know that'll save us money. And I'm like, oh, I just want to skate. And he's like, but your teammates, they like to go back home. And I'm like, nah, I just want to skate. So I'd organize. And that became the start of me they just knew. They knew they could save money. They just have to find somewhere for me to go on. And once I got to the States, other things would happen. So then you would shows would come up. You'd go ride Woodward or you'd go. So then I fell into this groove of I'd go to America, which on a standard visa is only for 3 months.
Mm.
So you'd have to go out of the country and then come back in again. And then you'd renew your 3 month visa. So that's what I used to do. So once I got there, I used my money from Roses, from my salary, and also my earnings from doing shows and the contests to fund my trip around and to stay overseas. So I'd literally go start the season, which started literally from 99. I'd go over to the States, stay there, fund myself until all the contests ran out, and then I'd come home. So I'd be over there for 10 months at a time, then I'd come home for 2 to 3 months, then I'd go away again for 10 months, and I'd literally follow that circuit. So it was really, really easy in terms of managing me for Roses because I'd literally just go away, stay on the road, keep going, and then when the season finished, I'd just come home. So they'd just buy me one ticket, which was pretty awesome. Then, of course, they'd put me up at the hotels. Once you got to the States, everything was so much cheaper because you were buying it there. When you had to buy stuff from Australia, like airplane tickets, it was like so much more expensive to do it that way. So then once I started on tour that 99, then ASA started to approach me and said, we've got some shows and stuff that that if you're interested, you know, we've always got shows coming up. And I'm like, sure, yeah, sign me up. I love doing shows. So then that got me into the show scene. And then, of course, just being over there for such a long period of time, people knew where you were. So then you just get contacted. So then you'd be constantly contacted with opportunities, contests. And then if I timed it right, I'd go to Europe, do a contest in Europe, come back to the States, go over to Europe again, and then you just continually renew your visa so you never had a problem, which is pretty wild.
Talking with particularly with, some of the other, old guys like Sessa and even Scott a bit, they're quite upfront about the kind of industry, sport, kind of professional realities and just going on one level, it's that, and when you own that and function within that system, in a sense, that's what you're describing functionally now, right? You're describing the fact that when you step up and give yourself to the whole thing, then other opportunities come your way. Are you looking back and seeing the wins of that, or were you at the time, did you have that kind of whatever it is, the business sense, industry sense, was it some of those other guys kind of helping you see things that way, or was it just happy accident that it ended up that way? Because it's a very smart thing what you did.
It's a, I call it the double-edged sword. On one side, I had Sessa as a mentor. Yep. So Sessa worded me up on everything. He told me everything. He told me what you need to tell immigration to get through so you didn't get in trouble, what to do when you get there in terms of how you set yourself up. There'll be times where you basically fund, you stay at a hotel or you stay at people's places until such time as a contest comes up when things get paid for and things like that.
Yeah.
So I had Sessa, who, once again, integral part of my success. Without him, not only, as I said before, he got my trip away, he got my chance, but he also told me the inner workings of how it all works, which was cool.
Yeah.
However, the other side of this was I just wanted to skate.
Yeah.
People don't sort of realize they outside looking in, and I know a few pros have talked about this, that, they saw me as way too serious with my skating. Because that's all I wanted to do. But don't get me wrong. Yes, I was serious, but I just loved the stuff so much.
Yeah, that's what keeps you going, right?
Yeah.
It only gets you so far, the hard work and blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bit surreal because at that time it was uncool to think of it that way. Like for the guys that had been in the scene for so long,
I'm not going to
name names, but they were like, very much in search of the love, not taking it too seriously, You know, it's just skating. We're just here to have fun. It's just there for fun. But I was always confused. I'm like, but if you want to have fun, wouldn't you want to do it all the time? Like, wouldn't you want to just – so there was this real disparity between where I was seeing the pros in terms of their mindsets and how laid back they were and stuff like that. And I was just like, man, I can't go a day without riding. Like, I literally love this stuff so much. One side of it is I feel like I'm losing my abilities if I don't ride every day, which is outrageous, of course, but that's just how I felt. I just didn't feel right if I wasn't riding all the time. And the other side of it, you've got to understand that I found my passion. And it's very hard to talk to people about passions because unless you've found your passion, now, well, that could be whatever it is. That could be your, you know, your partner in life. That could be a band. It could be anything. But you know that when you find it, that's all that matters, that it's all consuming and it will take over your life. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, then keep searching because you haven't found it yet. Once you find it, it's a furnace, a fuel that is self-sustainable. It's perpetual motion. It'll keep you going and drag you kicking and screaming through the mud and the fire and hell itself because that is all you are chasing, the feeling. You are chasing that passion and sometimes it drags you. It's just until the day comes, and you'll know it, where that's no longer the case. And if that's the case, then it's time to move on. It's time to find something else. For some people, you don't find that something else. You know, you can try to substitute other things. You can kind of chase, you know, that invisible dragon in other ways, but it's unfortunate if you can't find something else to go on with, which was one of the biggest things and problems and hurdles that I had transitioning out of the skating life. One side of the coin was that I was a bit burnt out because I had done it for 12 years, but the other side of it was I wasn't ready to let it go yet. So because I wasn't ready to let it go, that's another story. I'm not going to bum things out because, we're on the ride now, as we were discussing the early years of skating. And as I said, like, I just loved it that much that that's all I wanted to do. And if I wasn't riding day in, day out, then it drove me mad. And it drove me mad when others didn't really want to do that. I had to drag others kicking and screaming sometimes to ride. So it was pretty funny because when I used to come home from touring away, I'd tee up the sessions and I'd ride where the sessions were, and it was awesome. Like in those early days, you know, we had crews at Cranbourne, we had crews at Paran, we had crews out at Vermont. You know, it was awesome going out to Vermont when the old Vermont was still there and riding with the Vermont boys, you know, Simon Gillespie and Mike Bancroft, Paul Trice, all those crew. Like it was awesome. And then you had a slightly different crew that would ride at Cranbourne, and then you had more of a skateboarding crew that rode at Paran, which was awesome because, funnily enough, I just got along with all those guys. It was weird
I've got one more question. I'm going to cut you off. One more question before I need to sign off.
Man, go for it.
Throw this your way. So we talked briefly last time as you're getting into the competitions that kind of coping technicality trick, you know, that kind of grind stuff wasn't so much where you were at. But one other thing, and I don't know like how far forward we have to go for this, but one thing that was a major part of the, like there's the coping trick stuff, but actually that the number of rotations was another one, right? So chasing past 9 to 10 to 12 and so on. What was that like? You know, that kind of thing of going like, you know, when do you throw the spin that you sometimes land in practices in a competition? And whether, you know, I don't know whether there's like a particular story where you go, oh, this is the first time I, you know, hit one of those 10s or 12s in a competition. Because that's a pretty
Yeah, man. No. It's
Enterprise, you can be pretty nasty if you bail badly. So, is that enough to set you up to sort of talk about that? You know, chasing the spins.
Yeah, man. Like, for me, it was. I always, when it came to skating, I always chased the things that made me that gave me the best feeling. So for me, for some reason, vert ramp was just the thing that Sessa talks about it. It was just the thing that stands out. It's like. Yes. You know what? This feels good doing it. And look, I could spout poetry and get all poetic and metaphorical and all that sort of stuff in terms of the feeling you get, you know, leaving the ramp when it's all working and, you know, and you become a cog in the rotating machine and all that kind of stuff. It's awesome. And as you go, you just, and for me, there's two things that I kind of learned early on. One was visualization, and two, the planning process. So for me, what I used to do is I used to build blocks. As a kid, I used to love Lego. So I used to build Lego sets. I used to, you know, like throwing all the manuals away and building my own stuff and getting those bricks and blocking everything together. Well, skating is very similar. When you start building runs, you can look at runs and go, wow, that's 20 walls of just, I can't begin to fathom what's going on there until you start looking at things slightly differently. First of all, how much time do you have? Well, if you've got anywhere from 45 seconds to a minute, you're looking at around 18 to 20 walls. So time spent in there, that's how many walls you've got on the half pipe, depending, of course, upon how high you go. The higher you go, the less walls you have to plan. So you've just got to play with that. So you time it. You time how long does it take me to do this many walls. So from there you go, okay, I've got 18 walls to play with. How can I populate that 18 walls? All right, if I just go out and ride everything at once, then it becomes quite tedious in the fact that if I make it halfway, make it the 10th wall and fall, then that's I'm wasting, I'm not getting the best benefit. All right, what's another way we can approach this? Well, I can break my run up into five blocks. So instead of looking at it in 20 walls, I can go, all right, it's four blocks of five. So what I used to do in practice and training is I used to train in five blocks of five. So
each of those lace them together. Yeah.
Right. So I'd go, all right, so we'd do an air block, all right? An air block is five walls, all right? Cool. Then we'd use spin block number one, which may include, a 540, a flat spin, a setup, a 540 flat spin setup to flat three to Garfunkel to 720, something like that. So then what I would do
on earth is a Garfunkel? I wasn't even sure if that was a real trick or someone just hacked your Facebook page and made up a trick there. What's a Garfunkel? Yeah,
that's a story in itself. And that is one of my tricks that I invented, which is a fakey flat spin. So you come into it from fakey and you flat spin, ideally with your body facing downwards, and you flip around, you come forward. So it's 360 side flip basically that comes in forwards. Yeah. I'm not going to go off on the tangent for that, but that's my trick. I created it. It's got a funny name because of a story behind it. Anyway.
Yeah. Okay. We'll come back to that some future time.
Yeah. You block. So I used to block everything, which made it easy for shows, because then I would just go, all right, we'd do this block. And I kind of had these blocks itemized. So then the other thing that I used to do is I had a journal. So then I used to write down in my journal things that worked, how they went, how the blocks went together. So then what I would do is I'd draw a top-down picture of my ramp, the one that was coming up for the next contest, and then I'd put symbols on the one side for the left and right, and then on the other side for the left and right, and then a symbol for if there was a roll-in or a channel. And then I'd basically draw in like really integrated PlayStation controller Tony Hawk gaming combinations in terms of square, circle, cross, and that would just indicate what corner and side of the ramp I was on how the line would go together for 18 walls. So that's how I used to block my runs together. So as my tricks started to increase, I would create more blocks that I could put together like a Lego set to create my runs for competition. And with blocks, you make hard blocks, you make easy blocks. So then in the old days of the NIST competitions, it was head-to-head. So you'd have groups of four that would go head-to-head against each other, and the top two in those groups of four would go to the next round. So then you would look at who am I with, who am I competing against, what do I need to do to beat these guys to get to the next step of this contest.
Mm.
So I used to do pretty well at the NIST contest because I used to be able to block my tricks. I'd have, be able to change things up, move things around pretty easily to increase difficulty, lower difficulty, make things consistent. Because at that level, consistency is everything. Because one slip, one stumble, which is why I never used to go to the coping that often, because there was a higher degree of me tripping or stumbling over the particular trick, would send you down the list. You could potentially drop out of the top 10 if you had a stumble or a trip. That's without falling. If you fell, then you better do something gnarly to make up the fact that you fell. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, gotcha.
So, yeah, you'd have to really – so it would be better off to not fall and stumble than it was to you've got to complete the run. If you did a complete run, you placed and you got a better – you placed better in the standings. So, yeah, man, like you'd often hear the pros talking about safety runs. They do a safety run to gear them up for their next run. And until such time as I think it was around 2005, we didn't do jam sessions. They were all proper runs. So you'd have in the old days it was three runs. You had three runs, runs
in a minute. That's way better. And it makes a great audience drama as well for the three runs.
The thing that you find.
What are they gonna do? What are they gonna pull out of the hat? Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. The thing that you find with the standard runs is this is three standard runs, you've only got three or two, you've got 45 to a minute. You find that the pros will play it safe until the last round when they may throw down. Yeah. But jam format, the dynamic changes. It's more exciting because you've got more chances. You'll probably get in a jam format, which is usually around half an hour, you'll get 5 to 7 runs in. So you can imagine when you've got two runs, you've got to be very conservative. When you've got 5 to 7 runs, you better believe that there is going to be some fireworks go down, because as the pros start to get their runs down, they're going to get progressively more difficult as they go.
Yeah.
And you'll find that those that sort of use a similar strategy to what I used to use, you've got so much to draw upon. Because you just keep changing the blocks that you're using. So you just keep rearranging the blocks. And, of course, every ramp is different. Sometimes block 1A won't work because the corner on one side of the ramp is slightly oververted or it's a bit buckled or funky. So you've got to change things up and you rearrange the blocks.
Mm.
So, yeah, man, like it starts to become really, really interesting. So sort of to go, I guess, back to the original question, for me, the longer as I was progressing, the flip tricks and the spins, because that's what I was focused on, I started to become more confident and I started to dabble with different things and play around with a whole bunch of different ideas. Man, I wish I could do just half of what I used to do. I remember Sessa used to have a funny name for me when we were at Woodward. He used to call me Etus, which was a bit of a dig. Because I used to, my trick vocabulary was starting to become so large that he used to call me every trick under the sun, which would spell Etus. So it was a bit of a dig at sort of the number of tricks that I was sort of doing, both a bit of a dig and also a bit of a, you know, a bit of props and stuff. Granted, I didn't used to do my tricks that particular high, but my trick vocabulary was just, you know, there's a reason why they called me the Tasmanian Devil, because I used to spin much like the cartoon character. And the ASA guys, as soon as they made that correlation that I was from Tasmania and that I spun the, you know, all over the place, then it was just, it stuck. And then I went on the Looney Tunes Atai tour, which was Looney Tunes inspired by Warner Brothers show circuit that we used to do around the Walmarts around America.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah, man, that was like, I was one of the main guys that was sort of on that show circuit because of the fact that, one, I spun a lot, and two, my nickname was the Tasmanian Devil. So, yeah, it was just one of those evolutionary things as me as a skater that I like to air and I like to do flips and spins, that I just started to get really, really good at it because that's what I used to do all the time. So I was a real product of my environment, which is a topic for another conversation, was also one of my biggest handicaps because it created a situation which I'm not going to go into detail at this point in time, but it was coined McTwistitis, or an inability to air because of a reprogramming of your – basically your skating gets reprogrammed in a way, because skating is flow, you become quite lucid and your ability to learn is heightened, and those neural pathways are on such a fine edge that it doesn't take much to shift things and to reprogram those neural pathways because they require such fine motor control. So you hear people talk about losing tricks all the time. Mm. And I like to coin things, and it's not mine. It's Mike Bancroft's. He said this, one of the Vermont guys. And he said that skating is like having a garden, and you tend your garden. Some flowers and some plants flourish and others die off. And that is the nature of skating. You tend your garden as best you can to cultivate and to become better and to grow as a skater. However, there is so much to that garden you've got no control over that some days things, some flowers, some seasons, you know, your roses will bloom at certain times, and other times other things will bloom, and then other things will die off, and then you cultivate and so the cycle goes on. Unfortunately, some things will die off and you'll have to, you know, go back to the drawing board to relearn those things. And it's just the nature of skating. It's just the ebb and flow of what we do, in that you don't own the tricks that you have. You learn them, you rent them for a particular time, and you're lucky to have them for the time that you have. You be thankful and grateful for that, and then there will come a day when things will evolve, they will change, or they will disappear completely. And it's just a time to regroup, to refocus, and to grow in new directions. And that's just the growth cycle of skating. It's just how it goes.
Awesome, man. That's getting close to where we'll wrap up. So maybe we'll have to line up another time in the coming weeks to delve in a little further. But before we finish off, just so we've got the facts straight, is Wikipedia right in calling you the first one in competition to land a switch 10 and a front 12? Are those right?
Yeah, that's correct. I'm not gonna go too deep.
We'll come back to those. Come back to the stories on that. Yeah.
1260, 99, the 12 was my hardest trick by far. I was lucky enough to be able to do that, the first one, to be able to throw down. It's been done a couple of times over the history. I've got to do my maths. 3.5 rotations, forwards to forwards. So Sessa was the first guy to do a 1260. So he did a fakie 1260, and I was the first one to do a forwards to forwards 1260.
Yeah.
And I won't. I'm not going to add too much more to that. But
no. We'll come back to those. Needless to say, fact check those. Yeah.
One of the hardest tricks that I've ever done. I had to stop doing it because I kept giving myself concussions because of it. The other thing was the switch 1080 was an accident. I started out doing switch 540s because Tim Ward and Matt Salerno were doing unbelievable switch 720s and 540s. And I just thought that was just the coolest thing, so I wanted to learn that. I went from 540 to 720, and I discovered, hang on a minute, I'm turning the short way on my switch side, which makes it easier to land fakey with my tricks. And I had an epiphany, and I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. So the 720 worked really good. And then I'm like, you know, it'd be awesome. I'd love to go 900 on one side natural into unnatural 900 on the other side. So I started working, and I got a couple, and they got messy, and it was just too hard. It was just a very, very hard thing for me to do. And I'm like, ah, oh, this is so annoying. And then I started over-rotating the 9.
Just land backwards and, like, and you're fine.
What the? I'm over-rotating this. Oh, that's right. It's short spin. I'm short-turning this. I'll explain what that means at a later date. I'm short-turning. Oh, I could do a 1080. So that started me learning at Woodward and practicing on the resi switch 1080s. But it's not a switch because I can't do a natural 1080. This was always me and Brad's discussion. This is leads into what is natural, what is switch, what is unnatural. Is that correct? Opposite, I should say. Switch and unnatural are the same thing. Opposite. So once again, natural, switch, and opposite. So it's an opposite 1080 because I can't do it the natural way. If I could do it the natural way, it would be unnatural or switch. Does that make sense?
Cool.
So, yeah, so that is correct. So unnatural switch, unnatural 1080s, I learned that. Mm-hmm. And and I used to do those in shows, and then the 1260. Now, I did manage to put the 12 down at Philadelphia X Games and also the Gravity Games when it was in Cleveland, and I can't remember what year that was. I felt like I got kind of a little bit ripped off with that, with just through the difficulty, and I finished third place at X Games in with the 12, and I finished second at Gravity Games with a 1260. Granted, at the end of the day, it's a subjective sport. I've got no control over what happens. I'm still happy that I landed it at the end of the day. So the fact that, yes, I would have liked to have won a contest, one of the majors, throwing down a 12, look, at the end of the day, it's no biggie. I won quite a few best trick contests doing that that particular trick. And, look, I kind of had to stop doing it. It was too dangerous to do anymore.
Yeah.
And for reward, anyway, the reward just wasn't there. And as I said, too dangerous, had to stop doing it. But for the times that I managed to get it, it was pretty awesome, because if there was ever a trick that was completely blind and felt like you're in a washing machine, then that's what a 1260 feels like, because you have to feel the takeoff. You have to have enough height. Then you have to understand the orientation of what three rotations feels like. Then you drop out, which is the 180, which is the 180 out, which is where you open up to stop your rotation. That's when you can start to see again. So you don't know where you are. You only have an inkling of the when you took off, where the ramp might be, the numbers of light darks that you see, because the light is the sky, the dark is the ground, and you count the number of light darks that you see to know if you've done the right rotation. You open up and hope for the best, because by the time you open up, there is no time to go bail. So as you're rotating, picture this. You can sort of kind of close your eyes and visualize. Mm. You're rotating at a million miles an hour. It feels like you're in a washing machine, much like when you've just been slammed in a big barrel on your, if you're surfing, if you're a surfer. Surfing. You're being thrown around until such time as you slow down and you get to pop out of the water. That's where you open up. And Yeah, you're like, all right, am I in the right spot? If you are, you've already chosen at that washing machine moment, you've chosen, I'm going to land this or I'm going to bail. Not when you open up. So as you come out, you open up, you're not going, all right, I can land this. No, 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 no. You've already decided on whether you're going to land in the washing machine. So you're coming out to land. So that's where you have to be in the right spot. Because if you're not in the right spot and you're coming to land, you're either going to land it or you're going to take a wicked slam. It's that simple. It's 50-50. You know what I mean? That's why it was so difficult for me, because you had to pre-program the trick to land. You know what I'm saying?
We've got some footage online somewhere, don't we, of you sort of taking like multiple attempts at trying to get this.
Yeah, the absolute classic is the 99 gravity games. Yeah. I decided I'd put down, I was in a really good spot. It was me and Ty Chris battling for first place. And after the first runs, it was two runs, best one counts in the finals. I'd throw down my first run and I was sitting second. And I'm like, I can take this guy. All right, what do I do? I don't want to jump into this story too much. But I decided, I'm going to go for it. And, a lot of times I would have to spend four goes at getting it to land it. So once I learned that, at X Games and those other contests, I had to go four times in practice. I'd have to spin it four times, spin it four times, spin it four times. This was without landing because it was too dangerous to try to land. And then what I would do is I'd do my rotation and I'd feel it and I'd go, this is the one, and then I'd bail out. And if I was in the right spot, that would be the decider. And I'd be like, I can land this. So then the next one I would do would be all or nothing. Mm-hmm. I'd either land it or I'd take a wicked slam doing it. So what was funny was ASA used to see me after contests, practicing after the contest, 1260s, and they'd come up to me and they'd be like, why are you doing that now? Why weren't you doing that in the contest? And I'm like, you don't understand. I can't do this trick all the time. It's too gnarly. I'm gonna AO myself if I go for the landing and I'm not in the right spot. So that's what I used to do. After contests, I'd practice to get the feeling in the washing machine, can I land this, yes or no? And if I did, awesome, but I still wouldn't land it. So then you can kind of see the progression down the track, like as I got further down, but I can kind of go into more detail about that last time. So to answer your question in a roundabout way, yes, first one to do forwards to forwards 1260, first one to do opposite 1080s.
Wait, Matt, let's finish there. I've got to go. It's so good chatting, and I'll be in touch about next time.
Yeah, no worries, man. Absolute pleasure. And, thanks for the opportunity. It's been cool because I put it out on my socials and I got a bunch of feedback from all my old skating buddies and a lot of people I'm still in contact with, especially Nick. You know, he likes to give me a bit of grief now and then. So it was cool that they got to reminisce with myself about the good old days. So it was, super, super cool. So, thanks for the opportunity, and I'm looking forward to the next one, man.
Can't wait, Shane. All right, keep up the good work, man, and all the best with the skating. Catch ya.
No worries, Mikey. Thanks a lot, mate. Have a good one.
Mad Beef Rollerblading Podcast is produced by Mikey Lynch, theme music by Edifice Architect. You can subscribe to us on SoundCloud, iTunes, and Stitcher, and get in touch with us on our Facebook page. Mad Beef is supported by our growing number of Patreon patrons. To support the podcast, find us on Patreon, even just $2 a month. Every little bit helps.